tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So on these particular talks on Saturday night, or whenever it is, usually it's helpful, at least for the speaker anyway, to talk about something which is on my mind, and hopefully it's of benefit to other people. I won't tell you everything on my mind. Just the inspiring stuff. But as many of you know, that I've been working on a book about the hindrances. And this is a very, you can say, one hand a specialized topic. But this is also, as far as spiritual practice goes, very significant or important, useful. I mentioned to some people that when people come to spiritual practice, they usually like to hear about the positive things. They come for enlightenment, not the hindrances. They come to get something positive, to get some, you know, whatever, however you phrase it, however you want to define it. But it so happens that in practice, what we usually end up most of the time is dealing with various obstacles, obstructions to our enlightenment, or hindrances or something or other. And of course, the Buddha, of course, was very well aware of this. And so he made a point of pointing out these particular areas of experience, spiritual experience, and making a point of presenting it within the formal practice of developing mindfulness. So, I mean, there's two ways that these so-called hindrances, and the Buddha technically puts it down to five hindrances, a nice easy number, five. Some people might wonder why it's just five when, you know, our experience is usually hundreds. But I think you want to make it manageable, you know, just and keep it sort of succinct. And these are sort of the five basic ones, which cover, you know, there's all kinds of permutations of them. So they cover in their kind of broadest extent, they cover all the range of hindrances, obstructions, difficulties, obstacles we come across in spiritual practice. And the first, why they're called hindrances, because usually in the first way they're explained is in terms of developing concentration. It's helpful to have some degree of calmness of mind or concentration. And the kind of standard explanation is that one tries to develop this quality of concentration to a very refined degree. And, of course, having some of these obstructions in the way, they're hindrances to having a calm, clear, concentrated mind. And so when it's talked about these, especially the absorptions, the very deep levels of concentration, usually just one paragraph. And it says, and putting aside, abandoning the five hindrances, then they realize the first absorption. That's the first sentence. Of course, it might take some people, you know, a week, decades, a lifetime to get beyond the five hindrances. That's just the first sentence, you see. Didn't say how long it took to get that. But the second way they're explained is in terms of the development of mindfulness practice, which is very different. It's not just a matter of abandoning them, or getting rid of them, but is studying them. So the Buddha is saying, first of all, to be aware of these particular hindrances, I'll use that term anyway just to keep it simple, be aware of them, and maybe even that can take quite a long time. Who wants to be aware of their greed, aversion, delusion? Most of us spend a lot of our time avoiding it, kind of ignoring these negative aspects of our mind, these disturbances. But when mindfulness is developed to a certain degree, it just reveals it. Yeah, there is some restlessness, there is some dullness there, there is some doubt, whatever. Not to mention the very prominent ones like desire and aversion. And then we need some degree of mindfulness, which is a non-judgmental awareness, to be able to observe these particular aspects of mind, of our experience, and just to be able to observe them without reacting to them. I notice my own tendency is when I notice some of the, especially the negative ones, well, get rid of them. Shouldn't have that. And it's just like an automatic reflex, Aversion, not me. No. Must be due to somebody else, right? Somebody's thinking adverse thoughts in the room, so I'm picking it up. It's not mine. And then the Buddha says that once you're aware of them, to a certain degree, and this can take, don't need to talk in terms of time, but in the development of mindfulness can take some time because we're aware to a certain degree, and then reactions start in. Many of us have these old habits of just reacting. I can hear my mother saying, don't throw a tantrum. Don't be angry. And that was, she's already been dead for 10 years, but I can still hear her voice. Be a nice boy. Don't do that. Not to mention all the other teachers and everybody else, friends and trying to be helpful to us. Don't be angry. But that's probably one of the worst pieces of advice that they can give you. Maybe it's helpful in the beginning that you don't go overboard with it, but just to say don't have it, but I have. The reality is it's there. What do we do with it? What's some good advice? So the Buddha says you recognize it and then study it. What's the cause of it? All these experiences that we come across in our life have some cause. That was one of the Buddha's fundamental insights into causality. What we take to be ourself is just an effect of some causes. There's a whole set of causes there which we summarize and say, it must be me. But we're just the effect of these causes. But unless it's pointed out to you, or unless you make an effort to investigate, you don't notice all these causes. You just stay with the effect and react to that. So the Buddha is pointing out a way to study these particular experiences to find out what's behind it. And basically, unless we find out what the cause is, we're never going to really resolve it. All we do is just react to the effect and create another effect until you get back to the fundamental cause, and then you can relieve it, resolve it there, the fundamental cause. So sometimes it's very, very interesting to study some of these experiences because they're not what they first appear to be. Something like anger or something rather, if you look at it and can study it, you find out there's more to it than it first appears. And of course this is a theme to investigate then. The Buddha points this out too. Notice these particular hindrances, find out what the cause is, what leads to their cessation then. So this can take quite a bit of investigation from different levels of consciousness, different levels of mind. And sometimes maybe we're trying to inquire into some of these particular experiences, and then we don't see them very clearly. We're spun off into our reactions to them. All the old habits, the old memories, and it's very hard to actually look at them and be really at peace with them that we can investigate them more clearly. understand this, you know, as we're developing the practice, it's sort of like, you know, the benefit of calm meditation, calmness of mind allows a deeper seeing into more deeper levels of these particular causes, for example. And I think it was, Carl Jung said something like, problems are not solved at the same level of consciousness as they occur. I think that probably the Buddha would agree with that if we can agree upon the definition of consciousness, I guess. But, you know, the level of consciousness which some of these particular hindrances in this case occur, if we just try and relate to them at that same level of consciousness, that same level of awareness, we can't see through them. It really takes a bit of a wider, or say, expanded consciousness or more awareness to see what the cause and effect relationships are, you can say. So sometimes, you know, we, especially if these hindrances are very powerful, we can get very fixated upon them. Now that's why maybe it takes some effort to use some degree of calmness of mind, to use that calmness to investigate when these hindrances are not so empowered, not so overwhelming, so we can get some perspective on them. Otherwise, we're just spun off into usually our reactive syndromes, and then we just compound it. You know, people just react, you know, they experience some degree of aversion, they don't like it, and so they get averse to the aversion. They just react to it, rather than being able to observe it. So when the mind is somewhat calm in meditation practice, and you have some degree of awareness, then it's possible to look at this. What's really going on here? And not just as an intellectual inquiry, but from the point of view of meditation, from developing mindfulness, body, feeling tone, states of mind, and the related states of mind also. So maybe you can see that it is, you know, it does require some effort to be able to investigate. You know, in the Seven Factors of Awakening, after mindfulness, it's investigation of states, of dhammas, whatever we come across, investigate it. Not just a mental, just intellectual inquiry, but it needs to be a meditative inquiry into what some of these experiences are. So if we have that in mind, then we can transform, you can say. You can say some of these, my perspective is that these hindrances are just various expressions of ourself, some grasping of a self. And so if we're able to investigate them and study them, we learn about the nature of the self, how we put it together, and what makes the self tick, and can see beyond it then. Many times we can maybe just at least see how we're just, you know, automatic reactive syndromes. Somebody says something we don't like, and we'll just react without even thinking about it. Without even perceiving it rightly either. Sometimes you perceive what somebody says or what you see wrongly and then just react to it. And these old habits of reaction are very, very strongly ingrained, and then before you know it, it's taken you over. And if you go back and can investigate what's really going on here, maybe what happened, taken over. You know, in the Jungian psychology, they talk about people having their anima attacks. I remember reading about some guy, and he just said he had one of these kind of emotional outbursts, and he said, "Oh, it's okay. I'm just having an anima attack. It's okay. Don't take me seriously. It's been taken over by my anima." Just like, you know, you could say that in a Buddhist context too. It's been taken over my anger. Sorry. Just hang on a minute. Get myself together. But unless we're able to investigate and find out what the causes are, what's triggering it off, it's still going to be there. We never actually resolve it. So, and it's been unfortunate that, for example, the word, it's been, these hindrances are defined as hindrances. As in, at least in English, when you hear a hindrance, it means you want to get rid of it, you see. Whereas, I mean, from the point of view of wisdom, these are very useful and very valuable things to learn about and study. They're actually fertilizer for our practice. They increase the clarity, they increase the wisdom, they increase the understanding, and they can help us to learn how to let them go. And if we're just pushing aside or ignoring or trying to avoid these so-called hindrances, you'll never get free of them. You just end up compounding it, actually. You get the reaction to the reaction to the reaction then, and no solution to it. So the Buddha did give, you know, he did give certain particular meditations. If you notice there are certain hindrances which keep occurring again and again and again, then the Buddha suggests that you develop some meditations to deal with them. And this is something to do with, you know, I was reading a book about how habits are created. And interestingly enough, we can't stop an old habit. isn't that a bummer? isn't that bad news? We can't stop an old habit. So how do you stop your anger? If you've got an old habit, you've got a habit of anger, how do you stop it? Well, the theory is, the skill is, you develop a good habit. And these habits, they're ingrained into our mind. It's how the mind actually functions, pathways in your brain. And the basic truth behind it is, use it or lose it. You know, so if you have an old habit, say a bad one like anger or something or other, if you try and get rid of it, I've got to stop my anger. Well, you just keep increasing the old habit because you keep that in your mind all the time, you see. Whereas if you can develop a good habit, you give energy, you use the good habit, and the old habit fades away from lack of use. Sounds simple, right? So it'd be helpful to develop some of these meditations then. And the Buddha gives sort of a technical explanation of how some of these particular hindrances are developed. For example, aversion is created by giving too much attention to things which cause aversion. Basically, ugly things, or things which cause us to be irritated. We give too much attention to them. I mean, very simple. I mean, if you remember, you know, somebody insulted you or said something to you, and if you keep going over with it in your mind, of course, it increases your aversion, doesn't it? That person did that, and that person did that, and it just keeps increasing that habit. Whereas if you can bring up thoughts of forgiveness or friendliness towards them, then you bring up those thoughts and increase them, and then the negative thoughts of aversion begin to fade away. Because you're emphasizing another habit, a good habit then. That's just one way to deal with it. It's actually, when dealing with aversion, there's one of the longest list of various ways to deal with aversion, for example. Many different ways the Buddha suggested and put together in the various meditation books. Because different kind of aversions have different kind of sources. And first of all, you have to study it. What kind of aversion is it? Somebody mentioned this morning about my story of meeting the man on the ski track. Probably everybody's heard it. Most people have heard it by now. It's a good one anyway. And it's relevant. It's local. It's local aversion. When I was here years ago in the winter time, in the middle of the winter retreat. And I walked across the ski track over there and somebody stopped me and says, "Das ist streng verboten." Don't walk on the ski track. Yeah, so I got a little bit irritated. with him for that. So when I come back to my room, just okay, you know, just a little incident, I thought. But the next day, it's still there, reverberating through my mind. And usually, when I notice something keeps persisting, I know there's a longer story to it. You know, some of these events, they just, you know, they don't have much energy to them, they don't have much impact, and then they fade away after a while. But this one, next day, was still there. You know, what's with this guy anyway? Who does he think he is anyway? Second day, still there. My goodness, this is going to upset my retreat. Third day, still there. Oh my goodness. So then I notice that, you know, when something is persisting like that, there's a longer story to it. So maybe it's worth investigating. Give me some energy to investigate what's behind it, what's going on here. So I did give it some attention, and it was quite fortuitous in a way that it was a very strong physical impression. Because they can go off in your mind and, you know, have all kinds of opinions and views about it, but when there's a very strong physical impact, there's a very tangible point to keep your mind fixed on and possibly as a center for deeper investigation. So I could look at this. It was always there, and I looked at it and looked at it for about a week, and it changed. It wasn't actually aversion at all. It was resentment. And that's a big story in my life. You know, anger at that guy was one little, as it were, just the tip of the iceberg, you see. But obviously it somehow keyed into a bigger story, resentment. And then a lot of memories came up, and a lot of different images came up of different situations of resentment. Not just this guy, but, you know, story through my whole life. And that went on for a few days, and it still didn't end. So I looked at that too. And then that shifted. And it wasn't resentment, it was frustration. Wow, even a bigger story. You know, less specific, but kind of general frustration in life. Disappointment, frustration. Lots more memories came up, and all kinds of incidents. And once one could observe some of these expressions then, and not react to them again, ideally, they just kind of ran their course. But it still wasn't over yet, you know. Then I kept looking at that, and then the fear came up. And then I know it's getting close to the source when the fear is there. You know, these are just protective mechanisms for the self. I'm trying to protect myself from life and its frustrations and resentments and aversions, you see. And then looking at the fear, that took another week or so. To look at it and get a bit of perspective on it, a bit of distance on it, and say, opening to it, being more peaceful with it. And then it shifted. And then after the fear, there just was pure light, just energy. Yeah. Nothing to it, the source. And then I recognized that, you know, from that, I was like, I defined it as like life force. Just pure life force. And if I tried to hold on to it or try to make anything of it, the fear came back again. And there's life force there, and then we start to add our own little stories to it, trying to possess these things, these energies, and then they get distorted. You know, maybe we don't even plan it consciously, it happens to us. And then the stories begin. You know, fear and frustration and resentment and aversion and, yeah, just being able to see that there's just this kind of causal relationship, cause and effect relationship. So recognize it. Oh. And when you become aware of some aspect, you know, we can be quite grateful for it. Ah, there, that. Now I can try and follow it back, investigate it and follow it back to its source within the grasping of the self. That's where all the roots lie, ultimately. I mean, it can seem a bit abstract to many people because until you actually have a direct experience yourself, each one of us has our own particular stories, personalized stories of how we grasp the self, grasp this concept, idea of a self, and make our personality then out of it. And then some of these are just, they're ongoing patterns, you see. So once one begins to see some of these particular patterns, we can see through them, they recognize they are, you know, impersonal causal processes, get a bit of space around them anyway. But maybe they still persist. That's why the Buddha gives these different meditation practices that we can develop to help to deal with them so we don't keep compounding the same old thing, the same old patterns again and again and again. And you can see how aversion is cultivated in our minds, in our life. Well, unless you can do something about it, is you can change your attitude, you can say change your way of thinking, it just keeps going like that. That's like our default then. But then learning to develop some of these meditations can help us to change our whole attitude. There's the awareness of them, how they're developed, and then there's the, you know, what to do about them now, the mental development, how to cultivate a more skillful attitude. You know, and then there's these, each person has their own particular expressions. You know, the Buddha mentioned the basic five, you know, sensual desire, aversion, sleepiness and dullness, and restlessness, and then doubt. You can, you know, and maybe some people, they recognize they have a certain personality that way, a certain tendency that way. Other times, you know, some of these different hindrances come up in different stages of practice. And I would say that, you know, the more that we continue with spiritual practice, the more that we are, you know, come up against these different hindrances. These are the very fundamental, five fundamental ways in which the self expresses itself. And maybe they don't, you know, come out so clearly, like something like doubt, for example. That's the one I'm working on right now, doubt. I don't know too much about doubt. I have many doubts about doubt, actually. But doubt, I realize, can come across in many different ways. Some people have basic doubt. They doubt, you know, they hear some of these Buddhist teachings, enlightenment. Yeah, right. Who today can get enlightened? Come on. 21st century, yeah, that was for the Buddhas 2,500 years ago, right? Or you have doubt about certain aspects of the teachings, you know, or there can just be the general, not directly doubt about it, but you can't confirm it even. You can't verify it, you know, it's, even it sounds reasonable, but how do you know? When I was first practicing in Thailand, I just thought, well, you know, I'd even more or less kind of given up on enlightenment. But, you know, at least having some time in a quiet place, meditating, watching the breath, I could at least quiet my mind down, you see. And that worked for a little while. And then after a while, even that didn't work anymore. Too much restlessness and too much doubt. And but then I had the good fortune to meet Ajahn Chah. And then it was a real, like a real revelation in a way, that here was somebody who had many more years of practice, spiritual practice, and he was a very impressive figure, a very impressive person. And say more like a living embodiment of what I could read in the scriptures about the life of the Buddha and other disciples. They were a little bit abstract reading about them in the book, but meeting somebody like Ajahn Chah, you know, he was a very impressive figure. So I thought, oh, maybe it is possible. Yeah. Of course, then after a little while, I realized maybe it's only possible for Thai people. Westerners have too many doubts. But one time he said something like, he said, Westerners are like living in, they live in a very, very big house, he said. And if they can ever clear out the furniture, they got lots of space. But he was very encouraging that, in the sense that if you do the practice, you know, as people maybe have read some of his teachings, you practice a little bit and you get a little bit of peace. You practice a moderate amount, you get a moderate amount of peace. You practice a lot and you get a lot of peace. It's just a matter of doing the practice. And in another aspect of being with him was that I thought, you know, that being with so-called a seemingly wise person, I could get some wisdom out of him, you see. There was a wise person. I usually think that somebody who's enlightened is very wise. Yeah, but then one day he just said, oh, you know, I can't give any wisdom, he said. All I can give you is patience. Came halfway around the world for wisdom and all he can give us is patience. I could do that in Vancouver, I think. No, I guess I couldn't. But it took a while to get over that disappointment. But I realized how wise it was, actually. Because the wisdom is really knowing yourself. He can give you certain bits of advice. He can give you some insights that he has. But that's his wisdom, you see. And maybe in the beginning, you just live on borrowed wisdom for a while, you see. You borrow his wisdom, his inspiring sayings, or his understanding of the Buddha's teachings. You borrow it for a while. But unless you've seen it for yourself, it's not real wisdom. Anyway, when I first was in Thailand, I stayed in a monastery from a more of a scholar monk, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And he wrote quite a few books explaining about the Buddha's teachings, and many of them were very, very inspiring books, because he was not only a scholar monk, but he was also a meditator, so he could put these seemingly scholastic teachings into the context of experience. But I stayed in one of his monasteries for the first 3 years, and it was very helpful sometimes to read his books, because he was also, as a scholar, he could pick out the real essence of the Buddha's teachings. But the danger was that people could just read his books and didn't do the practice. And that's what I began to notice after a while in his monastery. That these young monks would come along and then they'd be quoting Ajahn Buddhadasa, you see. And I knew which book it was they were quoting, actually. But they themselves didn't have the realization, you see. They didn't actually have the practice to get the realization for themselves. They just read his book. So they could quote his book and it sounded very inspiring, but they weren't living up to the standards. So then I realized there's a limitation, you know, to especially having access to these inspiring books. You know, when I was in Vancouver, there was quite a bit of interest in Zen Buddhism. And of course, in Zen Buddhism, they usually mention about the enlightenment stories, you see. Somebody's meditating and they, you know, some bamboo bursts or something or other, and enlightenment, you know. They usually don't mention the 40 years they've been sitting meditation, watching their hindrances. They just mention enlightenment experience, you see. So people can think it's so easy. Go to meditate in Japan for enlightenment. And then you end up sitting there for 30 years or 40 years. But having an example like Ajahn Chah at least gives one the patience and continuity in practice to keep with the practice and keep doing it. And sometimes the hindrances can be overwhelming. Yeah, there was one time I had especially a real problem with sleepiness. I mean, I have a problem with sleepiness anyway in Thailand. I forgot about it. I went back there 2 years ago, and it was really a bit of a shock to go back to the heat. Must more the heat than the climate. It's so kind of warm and comfortable all the time. I call it the tropical slump. It seems to be so prevalent. I mean, years ago when we had one of our meetings in Thailand, I mentioned to one of the other monks, I said, "Oh, gee, I'm so sleepy here. You know, it must be jet lag." He said, "I just came from Australia. It can't be jet lag." Australia is only a couple of hours away, you see. That was the heat. And besides that heat, I mean, you can kind of adjust your daily routine, that you get up early in the morning and then you have a rest at midday, in the middle midday heat. But, still we have to go through these different challenges in the practice. And at Wat Nanachat, we used to have our evening meditation at 6 o'clock. It was getting a little bit cooler, but it was still pretty warm, especially in the hot season. It was also prime mosquito time. Mosquitoes were just waking up at 6 o'clock. But we had to sit there. Anyway, it was part of the routine, you see. You just sit there and you just know, okay, sleepiness and sweat and mosquitoes, and you have to endure through it. But when I was, after about 6 months in Thailand, I had a really sleepiness problem. I mean, it wasn't sleepiness, it was unconsciousness, actually. I just sat down and I don't know where I was. I woke up an hour later and what happened? I think this was first jhana, wasn't it? Definitely cessation of perception and feeling. But there wasn't any mindfulness at all. It was just unconsciousness. But fortunately, I had to go to Bangkok to get a visa, so I used the opportunity to go to a meditation monastery. And so I mentioned to the teacher about this problem. And it was a insight meditation monastery. So he just said, "Oh, be mindful of your sleepiness." But thanks. I mean, that's what I've been trying to do for the last 3 months, you know. But that's basically the advice he could give. Try and be aware of what this whole process of sleepiness is. And I was in the monastery for 3 months, nothing else to do anyway, so look at sleepiness for 3 months. Probably most people wouldn't have that chance, you see. They wouldn't bother with sleep. If they're looking at their sleepiness, they would just find some way to get away from it. But being in that meditation monastery, you weren't allowed to do anything except just watch your breathing or your sleepiness. So I that's what I tried to do. And the first month, couldn't see anything with sleepiness, consciousness. But then after the first month, I noticed it wasn't just sleepiness. There was neutral feeling first. Or no feeling. It was just neutral feeling. And then unconsciousness. And then the second month, I noticed there's something else there. There was a turning off. It was indifference. Indifference, neutral feeling tone, and then unconsciousness. That was a process of falling asleep. And then I realized what I'd actually been doing. I'd been cultivating indifference. I thought I was cultivating equanimity, you see. You hear this, people say, "Oh, Buddhists are equanimous, right? They're very equanimous, they don't get upset, and they don't get too excited about things, they just practice equanimity." Well, actually, equanimity is one of the most advanced states of meditation. Fourth of the Brahma Viharas, fourth of the divine abidings, equanimity. It's in the fourth absorption, is equanimity. Even more refined than rapture or happiness. So if one isn't at that level of refined state of consciousness, it's a danger is that one develops indifference, which is close to it. I say this is the corrupted cousin, you see. So you don't tune in with equanimity to reality, you turn off from it. And it's very equanimous. But you turn off and then you fall asleep, you see. So So that's what I realized I'd been doing for several months. I've been developing indifference, not equanimity. And then the result of it, the effect of this cause is sleepiness or unconsciousness. So it was, basically I had to stop developing indifference. And it took a little while. And then the sleepiness stopped. Of course, all the worry and confusion came back that I was indifferent to before. But, if one doesn't create the right or skillful attitudes, meditation, then they have, they have detrimental effects. And basically, this is how we developed our mind. We trained our mind that way. Not knowing what is a skillful way to train the mind. And then we end up with these particular hindrances, particular disturbances. So first of all, by being able to study how the mind is creating these different disturbances, the hindrances, we can learn to undo them. And then train the mind in a more skillful ways of thinking, of relating, of perceiving reality. Not in a negative way. It's going to cause more difficulty in the end. It's a matter of trying to, first of all, be aware of what these are. Tune into what the states of mind are. And of course, there's a great variety of them, positive and negative ones. So this is in the fourth stage of developing mindfulness. First of all, there's bodily sensations, and then there's feeling tones, and there's states of mind, and then the dhammas. This is being able to become more aware of the hindrances, the factors of awakening. We begin to notice some of these states of mind, and we see some of them are beneficial or positive, and then some are not so beneficial and positive. And begin to distinguish them. And then recognize what's useful to cultivate and what's not so useful to cultivate. But it takes some investigation of our states of mind to find out what they're all about. Many people think that meditation is just tranquility, calm. But the Buddha was teaching calm and insight. So it's a matter of trying to find the right balance. If the mind's not calm enough, we just start thinking about what we're looking at. My aversion comes from this and that, and oh yes, my mother did this, my father did that. So what? You still got it. But when you can be able to observe it at a more experiential level, from a calm state of mind, you see it from a different perspective. You see it more at an energy level then. What does this, in one sense, I would say these five hindrances, they are kind of fundamental. You can say fundamental existential expressions of our being. And we all need some degree of aversion because we get threatened all the time. Many threats to our being. So you need some way to prevent the threat from overwhelming you. But most of us overdo it, and then it becomes aversion. And sometimes the aversion story is outdated. It was a reaction to some particular threat, maybe when you're a little child or something, but we still carry that same habit in our mind. And then it just gets displaced into other particular so-called threats. But are they really true anymore? Most of them are outdated and don't work anymore, but we're still carrying that same habit. And maybe some people have developed these habits such that that's how their mind is programmed to operate. As soon as there's a slightest little hint of a threat, immediately aversion reaction to it, aversion reaction. if you want to be, continue with that and keep that program going, when you need to look at it at the energy level, you see how painful it is. This resistance and the contraction. You begin to recognize it. Not very skillful, is it? Then we can do something about it when you understand it. Really understand it at its real root. Where does it come from? What we can do about it. So the Buddha is giving us the possibility to study these particular so-called hindrances. And the interesting thing is, when you study them, you know, they don't become hindrances anymore. They become, as it were, fertilizer for our practice, something to investigate. When you understand, you know, just being aware sometimes that you, aversion has arisen. Very, very enlightening to know there's actually aversion there. Then, well, you're a bit more prepared for it and what to do with it. Maybe you can't always stop it because maybe it's still a very empowered reaction in you. But at least to recognize it, you know, you can recognize just how this particular being we call ourself, you think, I'm angry. I'm not angry. Anger's me. Anger's taken over me. Where did it come from? It's the reaction. You begin to see some of the impersonality of these particular emotions then. Yeah, you don't take them quite so seriously. You don't hang on to them so desperately anymore. You don't need to defend them. And you find that you don't have to keep reacting to them. And then maybe they don't get so compounded. They don't get so ingrained within us then. And then being able to recognize them and then see what's behind them. And it can be very, very interesting to study at a deeper level because some of these hindrances, they can lead us right back to the very source of grasping the sense of self. You know, they're like the obvious effect that's come up. So you wear the effect and then you follow back to its source. And that's where really the letting go really has an effect. Just saying, cool down, don't have any anger, just cool it. Yeah. Okay, doesn't really express itself too much. But still, what's going on in your system there? Because there is a trigger, it's still loaded. So one time you can cool it, the next time you blow it. Because the trigger is still loaded, you know, you haven't really found out what's the trigger there. You know, what's really setting you off, you see? So if you can study it, you can go right down to the very source of self and where you're holding on. So it can become a very valuable source of insight then. You know, and that's the only way we can really resolve it ultimately. And it's only some of these hindrances, like they say, the first level of awakening, doubt, is transcended. I'm not so sure. I have my doubts about that. I think the doubt they're talking about is really the doubt of the Buddha's practice, or doubt about the way of practice. That's transcended, because you've seen it does work. But there still can be other kinds of doubt, you know, about other aspects of ourself, even self-doubt, for example. You know, I think maybe that's some Buddhist teacher pointed out that probably doubt is one of the hardest ones for Westerners because we think so much. So we can have many different sources of doubt then, depending upon what you think about. And the more you think, the more doubt you have, basically. Doubt is a product of thinking. because thinking can only resolve certain level of reality. You can't think your way to enlightenment. So the more you think, the more doubt you have, because it doesn't encompass all of reality. And when you can settle the mind and reduce the thinking, then you can tune into a different level of perceiving reality. You can say it an intuitive level or something, or a level of awareness. Awareness is not thinking either. Awareness is beyond thinking. So we can quieten the thinking process down. We can tune into reality much more. And then we don't doubt it. We begin to know it directly then. But then if you think about it, well, is that the thought? Is that for sure? Is that just a thought? Is that a real thought? Or is it a confused thought? More doubts again. But in especially our modern societies emphasize thinking so much. And I wonder we're plagued with doubts. Whereas the Buddha realized that, you know, the way to deal with doubt is the quieting down. I mean, one of the biggest sources of doubt mentioned in the scriptures is thinking about yourself. How am I? Was I in the future? Was I in the past? Will I be in the future? All these thoughts about yourself, one of the biggest sources of doubt. But the being able to calm the mind down and quiet amid some of these conceptual proliferations, and the doubt ceases as well. You can just be able to become more aware of what's really going on, rather than all the concepts about it. The concepts, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other. It's just this. Simple. Ceasing of doubt. Of course, there's doubt about other things can come up, you know. But when we begin to recognize the various forms that doubt takes then, and these other hindrances also, many forms of sensual desire, many forms of aversion, many forms of sleepiness. Some people, they have real trouble with sleepiness. Other people, it's just dullness. They just walk around kind of spaced out most of the time, and not much clarity. They wouldn't say it's sleepiness. I mean, at least if you're nodding, it's obvious. But if you just sit there with a dull mind, you can look like you're enlightened sometimes. But no clarity, So that's why it's I usually say sloth and torpor. I define it as lethargy and sleepiness, you see. Lethargic state of mind, too. So when you begin to investigate them, you find there's quite a range that these different hindrances can express. And then you become more aware of them and you begin to recognize what's behind them all then. So being able to look at the hindrances, I mean, that's a, and say that it's a very valuable source of insight. The only way we really find out about the nature of ourself. We are these particular, I mean, in this sense, it's a little bit negative. We are this aversion and dullness and that. I mean, we're also, we're also friendliness and friendship and compassion and positive things too, but those we're quite happy to look at. Hindrances not so user friendly hindrances. For me, they make some effort to be able to investigate them. But interesting thing is, when you investigate them and can see through them, that's where the real insight comes. That's where the real liberation comes. I mean, being liberated from your compassion. You don't have to be liberated from your compassion, but liberated from your aversion. This is where most of us have to do some work. So rather than call them hindrances, maybe you should call them, jewels for insight. That sound better? I have my doubt jewel to work on tonight. Then when we begin to look at them, they get transformed. They get transformed into something very positive then. Rather than just think, a hindrance to get rid of. No, but we try to engage with it. And when we begin to investigate it, we can see right through it to something else. See where we're holding on, where we are imprisoned. And that's where the liberation happens, where you're imprisoned. That's where you can liberate yourself. So hopefully that you'll be able to appreciate the value of these hindrances and begin to work with them in a skillful way. I say try and work with them rather than against them. You try and work with them, then you can get transformed into insight and wisdom then. The wisdom of realizing the nature of your attachments, and then that's where liberation really happens. So I wish you all the best of luck, and hopefully you'll arrive at the state of wisdom and not deeper in the hindrances.
Andamayam dhamma uvarakata sadhukaranda dhamma se